Good morning. I'm so glad to welcome you to this session, Laughing with the Sinners, the Emerge of the Mormon Cult Movies. And the presenter today is Hugo Olaiz. He is originally from La Plata, Argentina. And I was talking with him, what is your favorite pastime when you were young? And he said, well, I like to read books. He said he read a lot of books when he was young. And he served a mission between the years in 87 and 88 in the Paraguay Asunción mission. And he got a college degree in the Universidad de La Plata in literature and classics. Also, he is currently a graduate student in Berkeley University. And he is working right now in his dissertation in Hispanic linguistics. And the respondent is Matt Workman. I hope I said your last name right. And he is originally from Rochester, New York. And he also served a mission in San Diego, a mission between 89 and 90. And he got a bachelor's degree in communication in BYU. And he was involved in the student review. He had a weekly column there. And he's currently part of the comedy troupe, the Monsters Act, and they are going to perform in the Democratic National Convention. So now it's your guys' turn.
Thank you, Manuel. I hope everyone came here to have a good time, because I certainly did. I guess Matt Workman and I are the sinners, so you guys can laugh with us. Before I forget, here there's a petition that I would like to pass around. If anyone of you have signed this petition before, yesterday it was stolen. So we would like to invite everyone. We are trying to start all over again, and we would like to invite everyone to help us pass it around. I would like to thank very much Matt Workman, who is a really, really funny guy. I have seen him doing things in Sense and Sessions before. I would like to thank Manuel, who came here to introduce us. And also, I would like to thank John Charles Staffy, who has helped me write a version of this paper that I submitted to Dialogue recently. Now, even though this paper is about Mormon cult movies, I will start by confessing that perhaps the topic doesn't stand by itself. In one sense, the only justification to talk about Mormon cult movies is the existence of Mormon cult audiences. And the truth is that liberal community subcultures, and maybe even countercultures, are one of the most neglected topics of Mormon studies. Perhaps part of the problem is the perception that Mormondom is so monolithic that if you are a liberal who enjoys watching a movie such as Plantain from Outer Space, then you are not really a Mormon. I did a lot of research trying to find some kind of sociological background for what I wanted to say, and all I could find were little glimpses. There are glimpses, for instance, in a paper by James Clayton published in 1968 in Dialogue. He mentions there the fact that urban Mormons, especially youth in college, have a really hard time conciliating their Mormon background with their secular experiences in the urban city. I also find glimpses in the 1984 book America's Saints. In one of the chapters, the authors talk about different cultures in Zion, and they establish categories such as what they call accommodationist or tightrope Mormons, autonomous Mormons, and even ex-Mormons. Finally, I find some glimpses in the research done by David Knowlton, who in past Sense and Symposiums, he has talked about things such as New Age Mormons. Now, while I talk a little bit about Mormon cult movies, I want everyone to think about two basic questions. The first one is, who exactly is a Mormon cult audience? Second, where do you draw the line between what is humorous, what is stupid, and what is offensive? The concept of cult movie applies to films ignored by the mainstream that have become the object of celebration by a small group of fans. Cult audiences believe that they have discovered something particular, discovered something in particular films that the average moviegoer and critic have missed. Since the release of the 1975 movie Rocky Horror Picture Show, cult movies almost became synonymous with young crowds, especially college students, who would get together and go to participate in alternative movie theaters in midnight shows. An example of an alternative movie theater here in Salt Lake City would be the Tower Theater in 9th South and 9th East. Now, hardcore fans go to the shows dressed as their favorite characters, recite some lines from the actors, and sometimes they even walk up to the screen and play their parts. In my paper, I try to attempt to organize my subject by talking about three types of Mormon cult movies. First, movies that were not made by Mormons, but that depict various aspects of Mormonism, often under a negative, in a negative or humorous light. Second, movies and film strips made by the LDS Church, especially during the 60s and the 70s, which make great targets of cultural criticism. Third and last, what Umberto Eco would call postmodern cult movies. These are films that enter in explicit dialogue with previous movies by recasting archetypes, quoting lines from other films, and satirizing old plots. My first category would include a broad range of films, from the silent anti-Mormon movies in the 20s to goofy westerns in the 70s. Trapped by the Mormons, for instance, is a silent movie made in Great Britain in 1922. The film strikes viewers today as comical, not only for its stereotypical presentation of heroes and villains, but also for its gross demonization of Mormon missionaries, who are presented as murderers, sex predators. By the way, for those of you who live here in Salt Lake City, the Tower Theater has copies available for rental, and probably even if you want to buy it. Now, Paint Your Wagon is a western from 1969, a rambunctious musical set in California during the Gold Rush. Even though the movie is about prospectors rather than Mormons, it depicts a Mormon woman who, in a humorous twist, ends up living with two husbands. The film was never intended as a serious movie. Today, it is widely available in video stores, and it is popular among some Mormon audiences. My second category of movies. This includes camp LDS productions, corny BYU melodramas, and morbid church-produced tragedies. Most of these films originally had a serious inspirational purpose, but over the years, they have been rediscovered as treasures of shtick and camp. Some, like Johnny Lingo, are so blatant in their political incorrectness that today they are perceived by many of us either as outrageous or hilarious, and sometimes both. Now, the LDS-produced melodramas of the 70s have been celebrated and satirized at Sanson's Symposium by Matt Workman and Sam Cannon. The duo produced a hilarious comedy routine where they played two melodramas, The Mailbox and Blind Love, and added their own dialogues. For morbid tragedies, Brian Waterman, Joanna Brooks, and Stacey Burton coined the expression film strip noir. This subcategory would include the didactic tragedy Cipher in the Snow, the gory allegory The Bridge, and the classic tearjerker Families Are Forever. The third and final category is a postmodern Mormon cult movie. In these relatively recent films, the intent is overt, to satirize traditional genres, archetypes, and plots. According to Umberto Eco, postmodern cult movies display an extreme intertextual awareness, assuming, of course, that the addressee is equally aware of the intended purpose. In this category, I place movies that revisit common places, replace stereotypical scenarios, and subvert classic themes. In the following paragraphs, I will focus on three movies that, in my opinion, they qualify as postmodern Mormon cult movies: Attack of the Brine Shrimp from 1972, Plantem from Outer Space, produced in 1995, and Orgasmo, released in 1998. According to Susan Sontag, science fiction films are not about science, but about disaster. And monster movies can be considered a subtype of science fiction movies. Attack of the Brine Shrimp evokes monster movies from the very title and follows faithfully the most archetypical of all monster movies plots. A vicious monster emerges from a body of water, heads to the city, and wreaks havoc and destruction. But Mike Cassidy adds Utah setting and a Mormon theme to this. And the result is humorous. The monster is here a giant brine shrimp that emerges from the Great Salt Lake, heads to Salt Lake City, and destroys the Brigham Young Monument on Main Street. We are going to see now a clip. This is the last 2 minutes of the attack of the brine shrimp. And I can warn you that the brine shrimp already destroyed the Brigham Young Monument and now is heading to the Salt Lake City Temple. Well, happy ending for the attack of the brine shrimp. As the final scene focuses on the seagull monument in Temple Square, the whole movie becomes a remake of the story of the crickets and the seagulls. Now, Plan 10 from Outer Space, and we need to get ready for the second clip. It's going to come in. It's coming up in 2 minutes. Plan 10 from Outer Space has a double merit. On the one hand, is as a stereotypical science fiction movie, it contains numerous similarities with the attack of the brine shrimp, and also contains extensions of its disaster narrative. On the other hand, it incorporates a number of themes from Mormon history, culture, theology, cosmology, and practice, always with emphasis on the bizarre, extraterrestrial life, angelic visitations, polygamy, Masonic signs, avenging Danites, mysterious writings, and secret records buried in the ground. We're going to see almost the final the beginning of the final scene in Plan 10 from Outer Space. The lady, Nihor, I think is her name, she said, this is not the place from now on, women are in charge, in case you didn't understand those words. To the Brigham Young what? It also gets destroyed, pulverized here. Yes, that's Susan Black, yes. She's in that spaceship that we saw. Now, Karen Black. Orgasmo. I have one paragraph on Orgasmo. We are going to get ready to see the clip. By the way, the clip of Orgasmo that I'm going to show is not rated. I don't know if it needs any rating. It's safe, yeah. Orgasmo, 1998. Because of the Sundance Festival that takes place here in Utah every year, South Park creator Trey Parker conceived the idea of writing, directing, and starring in a film with a Mormon element. The result was Orgasmo. This raunchy comedy tells the story of a Mormon missionary who, in order to afford the high cost of a temple wedding, sells his talent in the martial arts to the adult film industry and becomes superhero Orgasmo. Many humorous situations occur. The naive hero finds himself in the midst of the porn world and attempts to hide the true nature of his new profession from his Utah girlfriend. Because of his extreme vulgarity, this film received the infamous NC-17 rating. And now we're going to show a safe clip from Orgasmo. Conclusions. A cult movie requires, above all, a cult audience willing to participate in celebrating unusual films. They laugh at corny situations in sync, they quote silly lines in unison, and they celebrate bizarre plots in group. In the last 10 years, I have seen the emergence of such audiences in the Mormon culture. When I get together with my friends to lampoon Johnny Lingo or to see Trapped by the Mormons, I become part of such audience. When Matt Workman and Sam Cannon satirize the mailbox of blind love, they also become part of such an audience. When Utahns attend Plan 10 from Outer Space in alien costumes or Halloween parties dressed up as superhero Orgasmo, they also help keep the cult alive. The basic target of the brine shrimp, Plan 10 from Outer Space, and Orgasmo is not Mormonism, but movies themselves. They make the audience laugh by imitating the cheap cinematic techniques and the ridiculous situation from science fiction turkeys and from pornographic films. Umberto Eco says that cult episodes must have some archetypical appeal. In this sense, Plan 10 from Outer Space can be seen as a pastiche of cinematic and Mormon commonplaces. A hero finds a record buried in the ground, she is silenced by a mysterious conspiracy, and she discovers interplanetary travelers who come to the Earth with important messages. Just like in Attack from the Brine Shrimp, the movie begins with the Great Salt Lake and ends with the destruction of the Brigham Young Monument. Orgasmo, too, incorporates and satirizes tried characters and episodes that come from dramatic genres. From the drama, a naive hero is tantalized by the big city, sells his talent in order to make easy money, and finally redeems himself by turning against the evil forces that tempted him in the first place. From the adventure movies, a duo of heroes liberates women oppressed by villains. From the soap opera, a character assumes a new identity to evade a painful past. From the science fiction films, a scientist invents a new powerful weapon. I think it's called the Orgasmorator or something like that. Plan 10 from Outer Space celebrates aspects of Mormonism that many people, including some Mormons, find bizarre, and presents other aspects under an irreverent light of absurdity. In Orgasmo, the basic premise is humorous because it is absurd. The target of the satire seems to be evangelical Christianity rather than Mormonism, and the lack of accuracy in depicting the LDS element makes the show even funnier for the Mormon audience. Social institutions in general, and the LDS Church in particular, have a tendency to take themselves very seriously. Even institutions like Sandstone. As a cultural phenomenon, however, Mormonism is much bigger than the church. When liberal young Mormons and inside outsiders turn some of these movies into objects of cult celebration, they identified with a postmodern, subversive sense of humor, and they assume an irreverent attitude toward Mormonism. The mainstream LDS community is already showing relaxed attitudes towards the anti-Mormon movies of the silent era, but many are often perplexed by a subversive reading of Johnny Lingo or by the humor in Plan 10 from Outer Space. In his inquisitorial review of Orgasmo, for instance, Jeff Weiss, who happens to work for Desert News, complains that Parker didn't do any research regarding the LDS Church, and his sole intent seemed to be to depict the church in as negative a light as possible. But Jeff Weiss has completely missed the point. For the postmodern Mormon audience, the complete absurdity in Parker's premise is precisely what makes the movie so funny. The emergence of cult Mormon movies and audiences raises a number of social and cultural issues, from the status of inside outsiders in the Mormon community to the problem of deciding what is offensive, what is humorous, what is in good taste. Davis Bittner has observed that humor can help us recognize incongruities and complexities. Humor can help us define problems that otherwise would appear overwhelming. He suggests that Mormons pass the ultimate test of genuine humor when they are capable of laughing at themselves. As for the future, I believe Mormon cult movies will expand, and Mormon cult audiences will increase. As the years pass by, current cult movies will grow old and acquire additional cult appeal. If the LDS Church becomes more diverse and tolerant, perhaps the day will come when mainstream Mormons will respond to Plan 10 from Outer Space with the same humor and laughter they express today when they watch Trapped by the Mormons. Going back to my original question, where do you draw the line between what is in good taste and in bad taste, between being humorous and being offensive, between innocent mirth and malicious ridicule? I really don't know. I do not claim to have a universal answer, but I do not believe that Mormonism is monolithic. There are probably as many answers as there are Mormons. Thank you.
Respondent. Webster's Dictionary defines respondent as shining brilliantly. No, that's resplendent. A phonetically similar word right next to respondent in the dictionary. Respondent is actually a person who responds. Or a defendant, especially in divorce proceedings. I have been asked today to be the respondent to this particular paper. Although, the program has now changed it to where it simply says comments, thus kind of wrecking that joke. But a respondent is what you're going to get. Working upon the divorce idea, I decided to take a deliberately adversarial position towards this paper concerning Mormon cult films, and it was time to debunk it in any way possible. I figured the best way was to go straight to the church's website, where for many, many years they had posted a press release that said, flat out, there is no Mormon church. So answer me this. If there is no Mormon church, how can there be Mormon cult films? Something to think about. However, they've taken that off their website now, thus, again, ruining my joke. But it was there. I testify. however, now they have a very amusing section about, and I swear to you, this is how they say it, myth conceptions about the church, like MYTH-conceptions about the Mormon church. And I was happy that they had come up with something like myth conceptions, because just that term alone made me think of, I don't know if they have any of these here, but in the mission field, there are churches that aren't Mormon, and they'll oftentimes have the signs where each week, you know, with you can put the letters and spell out words and stuff, and you know, each week the pastor or whoever will have an inspirational message or some sort of little witty couplet that when you drive to work you should, you know, And there was one near where I work a couple of weeks ago that said, love triangles are oftentimes rectangles, W-R-E-C-K dash tangles. So with myth conceptions, we are slowly entering the mainstream of street sign Christianity. However, here's the deal. If you print out the myth conceptions page, the questions are gone. Only the answers remain. There's supposed to be there's supposed to be questions all that, like, you know, there's questions like, do you have more than one wife? And then there's the answer there. The question's gone. Only the answers remain. There's a gospel lesson to be learned there, although I don't know what it is. That's something for you to take home tonight and ponder. So, realizing that I was not going to be able to just simply debunk the paper via normal methods, I decided I should go read it. Which became difficult, as you can see, because in page 2, and I believe this merits rereading, not page 2, excuse me, page 3, early on in page 3, four, but again, I believe it merits a rereading. It starts in page 2 and goes to page 3. Expect more from your next respondent than you're getting now. it says, the LDS-produced melodramas of the 70s have been celebrated and satirized at the Sunstone Symposia by Matt Workman and Sam Cannon. So I read that, and so the first thing I had to do was call Sam and say, hey, we're in a paper. We're citation number 8 in a paper. Somebody mentioned us in a paper. So then we talked on the phone for hours about that. And then I called my girlfriend who, said, hey, wow, I'm a citation in a paper because we made fun of the mailbox. And then, you know, she, like, went to Harvard and, you know, cured cancer and produced peace in the Middle East for a couple months in the 1990s. You know, so she was like, yeah, well, I don't care. So I called Sam up again. We talked more about that reference in the paper, which took away, I think, critical time that I could have debunked this paper. But so I figured I'd talk more about when we debunked the mailbox, or not debunked it, but when we made fun of it. I grew up in upstate New York, outside of Rochester, actually just right outside of Palmyra. And there, back many years ago, we didn't have access to as many church media materials as you might have here in Utah. Instead, we had the relatives of the people that burned down the homes of the Mormons to begin with, you know, banging at our church door. Yeah, where's Joe Smith and his gold Bible? Bring him out! You know, he's gone. You got him the first time. We don't have another one. So, you know, that was my church-going experience. And we didn't get families there forever and the mailbox and all that. But one day, like, has anybody here not seen the mailbox? Good. All right. This is good because I want to describe it for you. Because when it was described for me, I just about peed my pants laughing. What happens is there's this really, really miserable old lady. And her kids don't like her anymore or they've just ignored her. And every day, and she lives like in Midway, Utah, or something, and has a driveway that's, you know, a half a mile long. And every day she puts on the galoshes and trudges out to her mailbox to go see if maybe her good-for-nothing kids have sent her a letter. And she waits, and the mailman comes, and there's oftentimes a little innocent flirtation between her and the mailman. And then there's a long walk back to her house, always nothing, maybe a gas bill, sometimes nothing at all. And then the next scene is her again putting on the galoshes and walking out to the mailbox and then waiting, and then there's no mail, and then she walks back. This series repeats itself no fewer than 4 or 5 times. Just walking there, walking back, walking there, walking back. Eventually, she walks there. She gets a letter from one of her kids. She's so excited, she has a heart attack and dies. I'm not making this up. She gets so excited about the letter, she has a heart attack and dies. And what she never learns, but you, the audience, learns, is that the letter was from her kid saying, "By the way, we're putting you away in a nursing home." "Life is a cold place. You will die alone with no friends. A message from your friends, the Mormons." And as soon as I heard about that movie, I said, that's so miserable, we have to make fun of it. And some people were surprised. "You're going to make fun of the mailbox? That poor old lady died. You can't make fun of her." But it was fun, and it worked. So, in response, I've used my allotted time. I've said, you know, one day I'm going to be the best respondent there ever was, but for now I'm in respondent infancy. This is my respondent milk before I get to the meat. I don't know what that means. But anyhow, hopefully this has provided you, the Sunstone audience, with a thoughtful and perhaps even provocative response to the idea of Mormon cult films and how they relate to your personal faith. We'll open things up to questions in just a moment, but now I'm going to leave this podium starting now. Thank you.
Thank you to Hugo and Matt, and now we are open for questions. We have a couple of minutes, 5 minutes. Yes.
It would be nice if he takes the microphone.
Yeah.
Oh, I got one.
To the person with the question.
Oh, it's like Donahue.
We have a question here. Maybe, but this is...
Oh, my goodness.
Okay, the question was, in Plan 10 from Outer Space...
Yeah, is that a variation of Ed Wood's movie, or is it completely different? The Ed Wood movie came out in the 40s and 50s, I think it was. The guy that's considered the worst director of all time.
Yes, I believe... I have seen, as preparation for my paper, I saw Plan 9 from Outer Space. It's said to be the worst science fiction movie ever made. I think that's an accurate statement. It's just the cheapest, the most horrible thing. He wanted to make reference to that in the title. What he didn't know, when I say he, I mean Trent Harris, the director. What he didn't know is that he was going to run into trouble with Hollywood lawyers who didn't want that title. And I think at the end they solved it, but there were some problems there. I don't know if that clarifies.
Next question.
Thank you. I've been tempted to either purchase or watch Orgasmo, but for fear of the NC-17 ratings, my wife can get ticked off if I bring that into my house.
Yeah, she might. Yeah, there's a lot of profanity. There's some nudity, not a lot of nudity, but there's some. It's extremely, extremely vulgar. Yeah, it's extremely vulgar.
Next question.
Do you think it deserves an NC-17? Do you think it deserved an NC-17 or should have gotten an R?
I think it did. I think it's an example of a movie that can be perceived by many, many people as offensive. Ironically, this was a movie that was very well received among the audience that goes to the Tower. It was the best grossing movie ever showed at the Tower. I presume most of the audiences were U of U students, probably most of them non-Mormons. That was one of the ironies. There was also some controversy about the NC-17. There was controversy in the ad because Deseret News has a policy that they don't show ads to NC-17 movies, and they didn't realize. For one day they showed the ad, and then they decided that they were violating their own policy, so they took it out. Yes.
Yes. Have you seen God's Army, and are you going to do a parody?
that's a good question. Well, the question that I was thinking...
Oh, that was for me? I have seen God's Army. I actually saw it here before it played in California. There probably will be a parody involved, although I'm hampered a little bit by the fact I'm almost ashamed to admit that I kind of liked it. I wasn't Citizen Kane or anything, but I was expecting much, much worse than I got. And it seemed often that, like, they actually probably got more right than they got wrong in that, making it a little tougher to parody. But there's enough in there that we'll find a way.
What I was going to say is that because the movie is deprived of certain elements that Mormon cult audiences enjoy, I don't think it's an easy element to become the object of Mormon cult.
I just wanted to make a comment for those who haven't seen Orgasmo and who might be interested. I went and saw it because I couldn't resist seeing Mormon culture clash head on with pop culture. I just couldn't miss that. And the language is undeniably foul. So if you have an aversion to many, many four-letter words, it might not be a good thing for you. But as far as the nudity went, there was more skin in Titanic. So if that helps you make a decision.
Kind of disappointing, I know.
There's also very careful description of certain sexual acts, a variety of sexual acts.
I have a question that might open a larger can of worms here. But it's kind of on a different subject, but it's one near and dear to my heart, which is, why do you think the movies that the church made in the 1970s were just so depressing? Like The Mailbox, old lady doesn't get any mail, then dies. You know, Cipher in the Snow, kid has no friends, then just falls face first into a snowbank.
Well, maybe someone has a response to that.
A Big Allen combination of guilt and love.
Can I add one more thing? I think the church and... I don't know, you can take this as a denunciation if you want. I think the church manipulates plus and then tells you that you're feeling the spirit. I think this is, and the church, you know, you hear some music, you know, in the background, and they tell you that you felt the spirit. And I think they do that in some of those tragedies. Particularly, Families Are Forever would be a good example. You're supposed to be crying at the end and feeling the spirit.
Yeah, but it was poorly developed, in my opinion. Because, and again, maybe this is, I've lived in Los Angeles too now, and I can talk about any film like this, but they show you the mom. The mom, she's the greatest mom in the world. They just tell you she's the greatest mom in the world and that, you know, she can play baseball or whatever. 2 seconds later, she's dying. Where's the time to get to, you know? I just didn't feel I was all that invested in this woman's life. I mean, you know, I felt sad. You know, every man's death diminishes me or whatever that thing is that noble people say. But at the same time, you know, I didn't know her. So it didn't bust me up as much as... It would otherwise. One other thing, I actually asked when we made fun of The Mailbox, like the cinematographer from the movie or one of the cameramen actually showed up, not Reed Smoot, the guy who, you know, lights everything really, really dark, but like his assistant or friend or whatever. And so I said, how come all the church films are so depressing back then? What was up with that? And he had two comments that, like, you know, one, back then we were really proud of these films. Because, you know, it was a quantum leap from what they were doing in the 50s and the 60s. And if you've ever seen the Deseret Sunday School's Up in Smoke, not the Cheech and Chong movie of the same name, but honest to goodness, there was a church film called Up in Smoke about the evils of smoking, where Utah actors in horrible Southern accents, you know, talk about, "Hey, we shouldn't smoke that." You know, it's not good. You know, I mean, you can see how Cypher in the Snow is much, much better than that. But apparently, the motion picture studio system back then, and maybe today, I'm not sure, works the same way that an actual movie studio does, and that you, the filmmakers, pitch a story to the studio heads, which in this case are, you know, Brethren in Salt Lake. And they said, those were the films that were getting green-lighted back in the 70s. You know, those, you know, we had ideas for other less bummer films, but those weren't getting the green lights. It was the unhappy films that did, and I have no idea why.
We want to thank Hugo and Matt again for all their efforts. Thank you for being here.